All right, so it's great to be back among my own tribe. Let me first include the standard disclaimer. You know what it is. I work for the government. I don't speak for the government. I speak for myself. Okay, so I've spent the last year as chief technologist at the Federal Trade Commission, and I want to talk a little bit about some of the things I've learned. I'm going to continue at the FTC as chief technologist through August. This is a little bit different than the standard sorts of positions that technologists often take in government. The FTC is not a funding agency. It doesn't fund research, nor is it what some people call science agencies. It's not an agency that's primarily in the business of doing technology or doing research. It's a policymaking and law enforcement agency. So I want to talk about my experience, and I'm going to also make a pitch for more people to do the kind of thing that I've done, to spend time in a policy agency in government, because it benefits the public and it benefits you as an individual for doing it, and it also benefits the field. Okay, so first I want to talk a little bit about the FTC, about the agency for those who don't know about it. I want to talk a little bit about what my job has been as chief technologist, and then we'll get on to what I've learned. Okay, about the FTC. The FTC has two main missions: consumer protection, which includes privacy as one of the big pieces, and also antitrust. And antitrust, of course, is just another flavor of consumer protection, because the benefit to consumer of competition is really the touchstone of antitrust policy these days. The FTC is a civil law enforcement agency, and that means that we do bring legal cases all the time, but it's civil cases, primarily against all varieties of commercial scams and misbehavior. If somebody is ripping somebody off on the internet, the FTC will be interested and may take action. And you may have heard that there are a few scams going on online. So we have plenty of work to do. We're an agency that is involved both in policymaking and administration. It's a small agency, about 1,200 employees altogether. It's structured as, and if you work in government, one of the things that you learn is that the way things are structured and where they fit in the org chart is important. That's why government people always start their talks with org charts. The FTC is an independent commission, which means that the agency is part of the executive branch, but not part of the administration. What that means is that the leaders of the agency don't serve at the pleasure of the president. The agency is run by a group of five commissioners, and the rules say that no more than three of them can be from the same political party. So in the normal state, there are three commissioners who are from the president's political party and two from the other major party. The commissioners are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. They serve fixed 7-year terms and stay on until their replacement is confirmed. The president designates one commissioner as the chairman, so typically that's a commissioner who comes from the president's political party. And the staff of the agency, other than the relatively few who work directly for the other commissioners, but the rest of the staff reports directly or indirectly to the chairman. Okay, so my job at the FTC is chief technologist. I'm not the CIO, that's somebody else. What that means is I'm not the person whose phone buzzes when the network goes down. And I'm glad of that. We have an excellent person to do that job. My job goes more to the missions of the agency. So I report to the chairman. I sit in the office of the chairman, nobody or almost nobody reports to me. That, in many respects, is the ideal place to be on the org chart. So I do three main jobs as the chief technologist. I'm first a senior policy advisor to the chairman on all matters relating to technology. I'm an in-house technology consultant, meaning that if there's some law enforcement matter going on that relates to technology, the people who are running those investigations or cases will often call on me for help or advice. And third, I'm an ambassador to the technology world. That's one of the reasons why I can come and do things like this. So what have I learned working in this job for the last year? I've learned a bunch of things, and I won't have time to go into all of them in the time that's available today. But But let me talk about a few of the things that I've learned. First of all, I think I've learned more about why government is different, what it is that makes government different from the private sector and from other sorts of institutions. Every institution is the way it is for a reason. It's easy from outside, I think, often to look at sectors and institutions that are different than our own and say, well, that's just stupid. Sometimes it's stupid, but if it's stupid, it's usually stupid for a reason. Institutions tend to be the way they are, and government is the way it is because it faces different constraints. Government doesn't face the constraint of the market. It doesn't face the same kind of law enforcement constraints, or not in the same way as other kinds of institutions, and therefore government will be different and is different. I've learned some things about the DC bubble, why it is that there's a DC bubble, and the mechanisms that cause it to operate, and maybe a few things about how to punch through it at times, which I think also are interesting. Those first two, why government is different and about the DC bubble, these are things that I'm going to set aside today. After I leave government, there'll be a longer version of this talk where I'll go into those things in more detail. But I want to talk about three things that areas where I think I've learned something that might be of interest. The first one is how to work with a decision maker who's not as expert as you are. The second one is the importance of soft power in policy making, as opposed to the sort of hard power that comes from specifically delegated legal authority. And third is the existence of clue-free zones or limited clue zones and what you can do to attack them. In addition to all of this, I've learned a lot of specifics about specific issues, specific personalities in government, and kind of the tradecraft of government, which also I'm going to set aside for maybe if you if we meet later today with beverages in our hands, we can talk more frankly about some of those things. All right, so let me talk first about how to cooperate with a decision maker. A big part of my job in the FTC is working with the chairman, John Leibowitz, my boss, and commissioners, and on specific policy issues. So I'm the technical expert, or imagine you're the technical expert, but someone else is the decision maker. How can you help them make good decisions? That's a role that you're often in if you are, whether you work for government, whether you work for a policy decision maker, or whether you're simply a person who's going to speak to your member of Congress or going to speak to an agency to try to get them to do something smarter. How can you work with that person? Well, so as technologists, as scientists, there are two models we tend to use that I think don't work very well. So let me talk about those two models that I don't think work as well, and then I'll talk about a model that I do think is a better one. So the first model that we often follow is the just the facts model. We'll give you the technical facts, then you make the decision. Everybody feels good about this. As an expert, you don't have to get your hands dirty with all the politics and personalities and so on. You can just be an oracle in a crypto protocol. You just sort of provide information on request. So the expert feels good. They don't have to get their hands dirty with politics. The decision maker feels good because they get to be the decider, and that is good. And that is good as well. But this often doesn't work very well. And why doesn't it work very well? Well, you could never really transfer enough information to turn the decision maker into an expert. There's always going to be important things that they don't know. But more important, what you can't transfer easily is your intuition about technical situations, about things that seem obvious to you as an expert, really can't be transferred uploaded into the brain of a decision maker. And so that model is often challenged and often leads to bad results. It leads to the expert providing a brain dump of information that turns out not to be useful to or able to be assimilated by a policymaker. The second model is that doesn't work is the one where you just tell the policymaker what to do. Look, here's the decision you should make. And that doesn't work for a very basic reason, because nobody elected you. The Senate did not confirm you. You're not the decision maker, and why should you be substituting your judgment for the decision maker's judgment? The decision maker just learns to ignore you. It's easy to slip into this mode. It's easy to just inject your own policy preferences into the conversation and say, look, this is just the thing you should do. But that also is not that helpful. So let me talk about how to do better and what I think I've learned is a good model by using an analogy. So imagine a colleague is visiting your hometown and wants advice on where to have dinner. Right? So now you're the expert on local dining. You know the restaurants. You know all about them. You're the expert. But your colleague is the decision maker. They're ultimately the one who has to eat the meal. So one approach you can use is the just the facts approach. You give them the menus of all the restaurants in town. You give them a textbook on nutrition. And they need everything. They now know everything they need to know to make the decision. Good luck. That's not so helpful. Another approach you can do is just tell them where to have dinner. Look, here's the place you should go. And maybe that works, or maybe it doesn't. But a better approach is to start asking them questions, to try to understand their preferences. Are you vegetarian? Do you like spicy food? How much do you want to spend? How much time do you have? Do you have a car? Are you a foodie, or are you a person who just wants some fuel? Once you know the answers to all of those questions, now you can really start to get, now you can really start to shape the decision space for them. Once you know that stuff, you can say, you can give them an answer like, well, there's a place that really sounds like it would be good for you, but it's a little bit more expensive. Or, yeah, you don't have a car, but if you're willing to get in a cab, you might like this place. It depends. I know you said you don't like Italian so much, but there's a fantastic Italian place just across the street from your hotel. Maybe you might want to consider that. But if not, here's another option. So you're narrowing down the options. You're explaining how the options that are available fit in with the values that they have. It's not for you to tell them whether they should be a vegetarian, but you can provide different advice depending on whether they are. And then be available to discuss it. They might come back and say, well, that sounds interesting, but there's this other thing, that other reason why a choice A that you gave me is maybe not what I want. Be available to discuss. Afterward, ask them what they did, what they chose, and how they liked it. Because that way, next time they come to town, you'll be able to give them even better advice. Right, so why does this work? Well, first of all, it's a multi-round and two-way protocol. And that's actually pretty important in getting to a good decision. One of the really valuable things you do as the local expert is to eliminate options that are obviously undesirable, either because they're just terrible, or the health department says you'll get sick if you eat there, or outcomes that are the right approach for somebody else but don't really match that decision maker's values. The other thing that the expert does is to shape the decision space. Not only say, here are a few solutions, here are a few outcomes that you might choose, but also say why you might choose A over B or B over C, based on things that the decision maker has said are important to them. Third, one of the reasons this approach works is that you learn from the process the first time and to try to do better next time. And ultimately, this process is about building a relationship and building trust between the decision maker and the expert. And the more you can do that, the more you can develop the kind of relationship where walking into the room, the decision maker feels like you already know what's important to them. You already have a good idea of how they see the value space. The more you can do that, and the more you can trust them to be making reasonable decisions based on the information that was provided, the better the relationship can be and the more productive. And this relationship building aspect of dealing with decision makers is something that I knew about before I went to government, but I didn't really fully appreciate until I spent time working there. Okay. A second thing that I think I've learned has to do with the role of soft power. Now, when I first showed up at the FTC, One of the first things I did is I did research about what is the legal authority of the agency. Because certainly any kind of formal act that the agency is going to do needs to be justified based on legal authority. It's a common mistake of people who first look at an agency like this to just think that, well, the agency can do whatever it wants. It's, quote unquote, a regulator and therefore can make any rule or establish any guidelines that it wants. But in fact, an executive branch agency can't do much of anything unless Congress authorizes it to do so. And in certain areas, an agency might have broad authorization from Congress. In other areas, it might not have authorization at all. So hard power is the legal authority to do things granted by Congress. And it's super important in thinking about how government would work, government does work, to understand the limits and boundaries of the hard power of a particular agency. And sometimes when a government agency does something that's hard to understand from the outside, the answer has to do with the limits on the hard power of that agency. But it's also the case that soft power can be incredibly important. Soft power is not the power to compel anybody to do something, but it's simply the ability to persuade someone or the ability to shape the agenda or to shape the debate. Soft power is acquired slowly over time. You have soft power because people believe that you have soft power. Soft power can be incredibly valuable because it can let you operate in a way that is more subtle and indirect and in spaces that are more complicated. Because it's a power to persuade or to shape the debate, it's a power that can be used with less fear of error in many respects than hard power. But soft power has to be nurtured. One of the things that I've really learned in government is the value of soft power and how soft power can be used well. All right, let me move on now to what's often the topic du jour in discussions of policy issues in the technical community, and that is the problem of low clue or clue-free zones and how to attack them. As an observer of Washington policy process from the inside, I've had a chance to see some degree of cluelessness at times, thankfully not as much within my own agency. And I've developed and being an academic, I've also developed a theory of cluelessness that involves different levels of cluelessness. So let me talk about the different levels of cluelessness that you might see or the cluelessness scale. So we can start with what I call level zero cluelessness. A person who's level zero clueless is not an expert, but they know how to find and work with experts. This is, in fact, not really cluelessness at all, in a sense. It's really kind of the desired state for someone who is a general purpose decision maker. If they know how to find and work with real experts, and they can develop those sorts of good working relationships, they can, in fact, make good decisions. In the same way that you can make good decisions about whether to have knee surgery, even though you're not an orthopedic surgeon. The solution to that problem is not for you to become an expert in orthopedic surgery. It's simply to have a good working relationship, to know how to take advantage of people who have that expertise and are working on your behalf. So when people say it's not okay for a member of Congress or policymaker to not understand how the internet works, I actually disagree with that. I think it is okay for them to not understand fully how these things work, as long as they know how to work with productively, to find and work productively with people who do understand those things. True expertise in the wide range of things that a general purpose decision maker has to work on is really too much to ask. Every decision maker should be, and many of them are, an expert in something. But they can't possibly be an expert in everything, because although we like to think that the thing that we do is the most complicated and requires the deepest expertise and the most and is sort of the most intricate and offers the largest opportunity for decision makers to go wrong by being non-expert, that's not really true. Almost everything that they make decisions about is complicated and requires expertise to fully understand. The art of being a good decision maker is not the ability to understand everything and at an expert's level, but simply the ability to function well. So level zero cluelessness, not expert, but know how to work and find and work with experts is, in fact, just fine. And that's what we should look for. Level one cluelessness, slightly more clueless than that, is someone who can recognize an expert when they see one, but doesn't really know how to work with them. Level two cluelessness is, at level two, you can't tell real experts from pseudo-experts. Certainly, we've seen some of that in tech policy discussion. And level three cluelessness, which shouldn't even exist but does in some places, is to not even recognize that there is such a thing as expertise in a field. And there are people, unfortunately, who are at that level with respect to information technology. So how do you attack cluelessness? What do you do if you get into a clue-free zone? Well, first of all, you need to recognize that a person of good faith who is at some point on the cluelessness scale will be willing to move along the scale if you help them. But it's not trivial to move along the scale because clues are not the sort of thing that you can just hand out directly. Or to put it another way, lots of people are handing out things that they say are clues. And if someone is, and it can be tough to tell the difference. So what do you do if you're dealing with someone who is clueless? One thing to note is that policymakers hate looking clueless. Now, sometimes they're unfairly made to seem clueless when they're not. But one of the things you can do to help motivate someone who you worry is on the cluelessness scale is to work with their fear of looking clueless and to try to help protect them against it. But the long-term solution to cluelessness really is to try to move people slowly up the cluelessness scale, just as we all did in our education within our own field. And that means teaching people to work with experts. It means showing them examples of what an expert is like. It wouldn't really be fair for us to just stand on the outside and say, how come you don't work with people like us, when we're not, in fact, going there and doing work to work with them. So to have experts embedded in the process and to develop long-term relationships of the sort I talked about before is really important and really is the key to making government decision-making processes better in terms of dealing with technology. Which brings me to the last part of my talk before I take questions, which is my sales pitch as to why you should do or should try to do the thing that I did, to actually spend time working within government or working in the core of the Washington policymaking process or the policymaking process of your own country. And there are a bunch of reasons why this is a good thing to do. For one thing, it's hugely educational. You can read, you can study, you can talk to people as much as you want from outside, but really there's no substitute for going there. I often use the analogy of to computer science, that if I were a computer scientist and I wanted to really understand the field, but I never actually put my hands on a keyboard and wrote some code, never actually interacted with the system itself, I would be missing a huge dimension, and my understanding of my field would necessarily be shallow. Well, the same thing is true with respect to the processes of government and policymaking. If you just sit on the outside and talk about it, read about it, it's not at all the same thing as doing it. Going and working in government is like going into the lab and actually putting your hands on the technology. And you develop a different kind of understanding when you do it, which is valuable for all kinds of reasons. The second reason why I want to urge you to engage in government in this way is that you actually have the opportunity to change how things work. Now, you need to be realistic. The way I often think about this work is that I am trying to move a very heavy weight, and therefore I should only expect to move it a relatively short distance. So if I can take this very, very heavy weight and move it a very short distance, I might actually have done a lot of good. To have even a small impact on the lives of 250 million US internet users, or a billion plus internet users worldwide, right? If working in government, you can make even an iota of difference to each of those billion people, you've actually done a lot of good in the aggregate. Compare that to if you're a researcher, having a relatively larger impact on a research community of, say, 1,000 people. or a moderate impact on 10,000 practitioners who work in your particular area. That's a good thing to do too. But you can have the same total impact by having quite a small influence on that those hundreds of millions or billions of people. And it's something you can actually do by picking an issue and working on it within within government. Third, good policy, good public policy is important to our field. If there's anything we've learned over the last 15 years or so of internet policy, it's that the decisions that get made by policymakers actually affect us, actually affect our work as computer scientists. And again, if we can move the needle even a little bit on the quality of policy decisions that are made, it's going to have an impact on our field, and it's something that we should view as an important service to the field. But finally, I think the biggest long-term value of engagement from our community in government, in the policy-making parts of government, is to move government as a whole and governments a little bit along that cluelessness scale, to try to make government smarter about technology. To get to a place where the kind of expertise that our community has to offer is recognized and respected universally across government, and opportunities to participate are opened up to the next generation of computer scientists. It takes time for people with particular kind of expertise or for a particular kind of knowledge to get into the seats of power, but that is something that I think is going to happen with people in our field, given the importance of what we do. Involvement leads to more soft power for our community, which is valuable in a lot of ways. We can look at certain other disciplines that have been really successful at getting themselves integrated into government processes. Economists are probably the leading example, or a little bit closer to home perhaps for us, physicists, who have gotten a lot of influence over government policymaking processes. They didn't do that overnight. They did that by engaging in a long-term strategy of engagement with government and of convincing people in government and in the policymaking community that what they brought to the table was valuable, and that they could contribute to better policymaking and they could contribute to the professional development of people in the field. If we can get to the place that economists are, or even to the place that physicists are, in terms of respect and involvement in government, we will not only have done a lot of good for our field, but we will have done a lot of good for the public. That's not something that we're going to do overnight, but I'm firmly convinced that we need to do it, and the only way that it can happen is if people like you are actually thinking about spending time in government and contributing to the policymaking process more directly. All right, so with that sales pitch, I'll stop talking, and I'd be happy to take questions. Thanks.
Hi, John Griffin with Telecommunication Systems. I have a two-part question. One is, I suspect you didn't get your job by going to usajobs.gov and just searching for, chief technologist. When I've talked with people, say DARPA program managers, they've talked about the process of, oh well, if you're interested in having this kind of role in government, here's the steps you have to walk through, here's the people you have to talk to, here's all the things you need to do to get the position. So I'm curious, in your case, how this opportunity opened itself up in the context of how we could get similar jobs.
Sure. So, like any job, right? There's an HR process, but connections and recommendations from people who know the person making the hiring decision are super important. And one of the reasons why I think it's important for us to be involved is that we could then become recommenders. And certainly I will be, I think, likely a recommender for these sorts of positions in the future. In my own case, I think it was people who were involved in government already and knew me from past interactions that played a key role in introducing me to and helping to do the matchmaking. Now, the other thing that happened in my case at the FTC is that the agency, the chairman, made a decision that this position should exist, because the position I'm in was a new position when it was created. But it's now something which is turning into a longer-term position. So there's no simple answer except developing relationships. And I think as our community becomes more integrated, the sort of natural connections within our community are going to lead to recommendations of this sort. It will become easier as more of us do this.
Thank you. The other part of my question was related to your levels of cluelessness, which I was especially interested, given your academic background, that you didn't touch on levels of cluefulness, right? That it seems like maybe the first step for people like us in this community isn't so much to work on getting people to move up the cluefulness scale or cluelessness scale, but getting ourselves to have better skills at, you know, conveying the clue.
That's right, because that's absolutely right. It's important to think about this in a relatively symmetric way, right? That we often are clueless about these policymaking processes, about how they work, sometimes about the formal rules of how they work, sometimes about the actual facts about how they work. There's a lot about how government works that you didn't learn in high school civics class, and which is not to say that stuff is bad. It's just a level of detail about how, say, congressional committees work in practice, how legislative drafting works in practice, and so on and so on. That's important to know. And so we need to work on getting ourselves up this scale as well, so that when we engage with government, we know what's going on. It's not okay to not know how government works. But in the same way, we can amplify our own effectiveness by working with people who have more expertise in that area. So it's important also, I think, to develop relationships with people outside our own community who know more about how government and policymaking processes work. It's absolutely right, we need to be more clueful as well, because the key to being effective is often to understand what the terrain is, who your likely allies are, and how you might convince them. Matt.
Hi, Matt Blaze, UPenn. So one of the things that is interesting about the FTC and your talk is it's a regulatory agency. The things that it tends to do are very important, but much less dramatic than things that go on the Hill, right? Can you apply the lessons you've learned to how the lawmaking process and clue injection there is, and you know, perhaps that's a larger question than we have time for.
Well, certainly, I've worked with folks on the Hill before joining the government, and in my role at the FTC, we've had a lot of dealings with folks on the Hill. It's certainly true that if you look at an agency like the FTC, it has certain areas of focus, and it's viewed as sort of an expert agency in certain respects. Whereas Congress is by nature a generalist organization, and members of Congress have relatively few staff compared to the complexity of the issues they have to deal with. And so their challenges, I think, are greater than the challenges that we often face in the executive branch. But certainly, in talking about this, I meant it to apply to Congress. I think it's even more important to do these things well in dealing with Congress, because their challenges are so much greater in dealing with the complexity.
So basically, the same answers apply.
I think the same answers do apply. As far, at least that's my. That's my belief. Yeah. So, thank you.